Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Kerri Miller. This is NPR News. We're following news of House Speaker Paul Ryan's decision to leave Congress at the end of his term, and we'll have some analysis on that later in the hour and at 11. This hour, why the facts about immigration are too rarely part of the political debate about it. Is there any other issue in which such pervasive myths persist? And when I say myths, I mean beliefs about immigration that are not supported by fact. Even as President Trump was announcing his presidential campaign with these assertions about undocumented immigrants, there were no facts to support them.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
And there are still no facts to support what he said most recently about immigrants as the president deployed National Guard troops to the southern border. What is it about immigration that opens the door to mythology and even demagoguery? And why is it so difficult to make the facts stick, no matter what your politics are on the issue? Two guests to consider this with us and your thoughts, too. If you're a first or second generation immigrant, what do you think is most misunderstood about who you are? And for the rest of us, is America getting more uncomfortable with our identity as a nation of immigrants? So I'd like to hear about your own experience as a first or second generation immigrant to the United States. What's misunderstood about your experience? For the rest of us, do you think the United States, we Americans, are getting more uncomfortable about our identity as a nation of immigrants? Here's the phone number on that, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at KerriNPR. Alan Gomez is with us. He covers immigration at USA Today, and he joins us today from Miami. And Alan, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Collins is with us. She's Deputy Director of Economic Growth at the George W. Bush Institute, and she's with us from Dallas. And Laura, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alan, I want to say this. I understand that immigration is it's a core principle of American identity, and that means that it's really complicated. But I want to start off with a big question here. Why is it that this seems to be an issue that, as I said, encourages a lot of demagoguery and mythology and just does not, that the facts don't seem very sticky when we debate this issue? You must have some thoughts on this, having covered it for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's what makes immigration so fascinating is that it's, on the one hand, a very American tradition. It's how this country was founded. It's how this country has grown. It's how this country has flourished over the centuries. But at the same time, we have a very longstanding American tradition of also bashing immigrants when it suits us. Going all the way back to when, you know, the first Italians started coming over, when the first Irish started coming over. I mean, this is something that we have done in this country for a very, very long time. And what we're seeing now is a sharp rise over the last few decades of people coming from Latin America and Asia. And so I think that's part of the reason why now it's them. Now it's their turn to get picked on, basically. And yeah, it's really hard in this context to have an informed debate because it's such you know, unlike, you know, it's one thing to talk about a trade war and get into the finances of it, but it's very different when you're talking with something that is, it hits people at such a gut level, and it becomes so emotional that sometimes, you're right, it's just hard to get into the reality of it and get to the underlying facts behind it.
You know, Laura, I hear what Alan is saying loud and clear, that this is not a new phenomenon in the United States. If you go back to what Benjamin Franklin was writing and saying about German immigrants, you will find a lot of kind of similar rhetoric. Why is it, though, that the facts seem so unpersuasive in this debate?
Well, I think most people look at what they see around them. So they're not scared of the immigrant next door, but they might be scared of the immigrant 2,000 miles away that they think is coming across the border, whether they are or they aren't. And so it's really about your personal relationships in your community and how does your community respond. I know that there are in states where immigration is pretty traditional, particularly talking about California and Texas and Florida, it's less, I think, of an issue than it is in places where immigrants are starting to move. And so there are organizations working with communities to say, hey, how do you reach out and how do you make sure that your community is embracing these people and helping them to integrate? And, you know, Alan raised some interesting points on we've always said these things about every group, and the reason it goes away is that you see an end to the wave of those groups. And we haven't quite seen an end to the wave of Hispanic immigration. And we definitely haven't seen an end to the wave of Asian immigration. And I think that as people see those waves cresting, you'll see that you don't have any more first generation that don't speak English very well because their children and their grandchildren are all fully integrated, fully assimilated. They speak English. They are typical Americans. And as you see those waves cresting, then those animosities will go away for the groups they're in right now, and they'll move on to the next group.
Let me take a call. Laura, one of the things you're bringing up here is this tension around the idea of what assimilation is. And we have a caller on the line who I think wants to talk about that, to Abdi in St. Paul. Abdi, is that something you're thinking about?
Yes. I'm from St. Paul. I grew up here, but I'm from Somalia. My family came here as refugees. And right now, especially in the political discourse in Minnesota, we're hearing a lot about Somalis not being able to assimilate and just Muslim migrants as a whole. And I take issue with that because, I mean, obviously being, you know, raised here but not born here, I identify as American. My cousins, all five of them, all play hockey in the Twin Cities area. Probably a very rare occurrence, but I mean,
I was going to say, Abdi, if that's not Minnesotan, I don't know what is, right?
Exactly, right? And I have an uncle who works in the zoning district, but I do want to push back a little bit. I've called before. I'm a huge Trump supporter, also another kind of anomaly. But when we talk about this, I do want to make the distinction between illegal immigration and immigrants, because we came here as refugees. Completely different from those who unfortunately came here illegally, but for good reason, I'm sure they wanted to escape some of the same stuff that we did. But when we have 80%, according to the Huffington Post, of women coming from the border being sexually assaulted, that is an issue to me, and that's a concern to me, as well as the crime and stuff that comes through. So I don't know if there's myths, but sometimes the conflation and demonization of those people is not right. But I do want to make that
decision. Abdi, I can't let you go, though. I really can't let you go without asking you about what seems pretty counterintuitive to me. You are concerned about the way immigration is discussed. And as I pointed out at the beginning of the show, President Trump says a lot of things that are just generally not true about immigration. And yet you're here to say I think you said I'm a huge supporter of President Trump. So how do you reconcile that?
So let's take it back, right? So when we see, again, when he said there are rapists, I would hope he doesn't mean every single immigrant coming over the border from Mexico or Central America is a rapist themselves, but he's saying some people who we don't know their background, they come undocumented, we don't know their legal history, criminal background, they come here and they possibly are rapists.
And there are people in the general white population of the United States that are rapists, too.
Exactly. And those people are accounted for because of our legal systems. And if they come from areas of Mexico, Honduras, or Guatemala, you know, all these other places where we can't have a background check, as well as these Muslim countries who we've also had on this travel ban, including Somalia, where I'm from, if there is a breakdown in that political process or that immigrant process, then we don't have the resources as we would for a white guy named John, you know, from Wyoming. So there is that being, there's something there being conflated. Also, just to kind of, you know, have some concession here, what happened in Honduras with the coup that we supported, which Hillary Clinton, you know, potentially, I mean, pretty much bragged about in her book, and what we've done in the Middle East and countries like Somalia for the past few, you know, couple decades, is abhorrent, and that's what's leading to these mass migrant movements.
Okay.
So we're not innocent from that.
You've given us a lot to talk about, Abdi. I'm really glad you called. Let me go to Alan first. Alan, what do you make of this?
I mean, just like you said, there's about seven things in there that I'd love to unpack a little bit more. But let me just start with one of the first things that Abdi talked about, is that difference between undocumented immigration and legal immigration. And it's very important to note, I think, that, you know, early on, especially during the campaign, candidate Trump was talking a lot about illegal immigration, and that was the focus as he transitioned into office. You know, we all were starting to write a lot about his attempts to limit both legal and illegal immigration.
That's right.
And I can't tell you how many angry emails I got from Trump supporters saying, no, he's only talking about illegal immigration. Why do you keep conflating the two? And the first 15 months of his administration has shown that he absolutely wants to do both. He has cut a program called Temporary Protected Status that has protected almost 200,000 Salvadorans, another 40-some thousand Haitians, a couple thousand Nicaraguans. He's expected to end temporary protected status for Hondurans. That's another 57,000 people. And so that's a legal immigration program where they were allowed to stay here legally. So that's going to be 250,000 people that they're trying to kick out. He's reduced the refugee admission program. Last year, we admitted 29,000 refugees. That's down from 99,000 the year before and is the lowest since 1980. And he's more recently talked about ending what he refers to as chain migration, which is family-based migration into the United States. So when you put all those together, it's very clear that it's not just illegal immigration that he's after. His administration has gone after several different ways to try to reduce the number of legal immigrants coming into the country and to remove some of them that are in the country right now.
Laura, do you draw a bright line between the way the president speaks and I think we can take him at his word, clearly feels about illegal immigration, and then the way he speaks and feels about legal immigration when you take into account some of the policies as Alan laid them out that he wants to put into effect?
I think he's been very consistent about illegal immigration and how he feels about people who are undocumented. I don't think he's been as consistent in his rhetoric about legal immigrants, but the policies the administration's putting forth, Alan's right, tend to be policies that are undercutting legal immigration. I mean, they put forth during the debate about the fix for Dreamers, they put forth a proposition to drastically slash legal immigration levels. We know even for the H-1B temporary visa program, the stepped up vetting, and there's talk about possibly revoking the work authorization for spouses of H-1B visa holders. And so that's about 100,000 people that wouldn't have the ability to work, who are forced to sit at home and not contribute to the economy. So we do know that there are policies that are undercutting legal immigration, regardless of whether his rhetoric has been consistent or not.
I have to say, I didn't know that about the spouses of the H-1B immigrant. What kind of a population is that? And how many people would you think would be affected by that?
Yeah, so a little background on this. Most spouses who join a spouse on a work visa come in on what's called an H-4, and the vast majority of spouses are not allowed to work on an H-4. There was a carve-out in, I think, 2015, where they made an exception for spouses of H-1B visa holders so that they could work. And this population reflects what the population the H-1B visa holders is. They're highly skilled. Most of them are highly educated, heavily Indian-American. And so it's a population of people who can contribute to the economy in really good ways and want to work. And they're often forced to sit at home for several years at a time. The H-1B visa only lasts for 3 years, and you can renew it twice unless you apply for a green card. And so if your employer is sponsoring you for a green card, then you get in line. And as we know, the lines for green cards are extraordinarily long, and the wait times are extraordinarily long. So you're talking about spouses who may miss 16 years, depending on where their spouse is from, waiting for the ability to work.
Abir says on Twitter, first generation, I think misunderstanding is fueled in part by liberals, too. In order to fight the right's nationalism, Democrats say things like we're a nation of immigrants and immigrants love America, making us ungrateful for having criticism and ignoring Native and Black people. If you've just gotten in on the conversation, we're talking about why this is, and I'm not saying this is the only political debate where facts seem to take a backseat to mythology and demagoguery, but boy, we talk about immigration so often and debate it in so often an uninformed way. And so we thought this conversation could go towards providing some facts, providing some context around that and understanding why this is an issue that is so often misrepresented. So Alan Gomez was willing to do that with us. He's an immigration reporter at USA Today, and so was Laura Collins. She's a deputy director of economic growth at the George W. Bush Institute. Asking you this morning, first or second generation immigrant, what do you think is most misunderstood about who you are? We heard this issue about assimilation. I think we'll come back to that, too. For the rest of us, is America and Americans getting more uncomfortable with our identity as a nation of immigrants? Think about that. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at CarrieNPR to Paul in St. Cloud. Hey, Paul, thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak. I'm also glad that you kind of walked back your opening statement a little bit there just now. But I just wanted to point out that it seems to be like a defining characteristic in hot button issues, the fact that we do go into this demagoguery and throw facts out the window. And basically one side digs in and the other side digs in and then they just, you know, fight with their feelings. And when you look at anything, you know, from gun control to welfare reform to, you know, anything, immigration included, that's exactly what makes it a hot button issue, is that it's the demagoguery and the you know, the feelings over facts that win the day.
Well, I don't know, Paul. I mean, Laura, I think, had a good argument about we debate tariffs, you know, and trade. That's a hot button issue at the moment. We don't seem to use the kind of language around that we do with immigration. Laura, you want to say something else on that?
Well, you know, we do debate tariffs and trade, but they're not dealing with people specifically. They're dealing with industries. And while there are people that are important to those industries and people whose jobs are very important to them, it's abstract. They're products and services.
So maybe that's why it's so emotional. And Paul, I appreciate the point here. Alan, a little earlier, you brought up the idea of chain migration. And even the this just shows that even the language around that, the terms that you use are specific to evoking a kind of emotional response. So conservatives have begun, and so has President Trump, have begun calling this chain migration. And the president said this in his State of the Union speech. Under the current broken system, a single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. I thought there were pretty strict limits to what is commonly referred to as family migration. What do you hear in the way that language is used?
Yeah, and there's two things going on there. First is the use of the term chain migration. You know, it's a derogatory term that was developed by groups that want to limit immigration into the country, when really what it is just family-based migration. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with calling it that. That's been the bedrock of our immigration system for a very, very long time. You know, using that term just kind of makes it a little bit more sinister, makes it sound a little bit more devious. But the other part of it is when President Trump and his entire administration has been making this argument repeatedly. They put out graphs. They put out, you know, all sorts of materials showing how one person can bring in these dozens and dozens of relatives immediately. Ask any person who's gone through the U.S. immigration system, and that's not how it works. There is a limit to the number of relatives you're allowed to bring in. Your immediate family obviously can come in quicker, but then you're allowed to bring in siblings, parents, and a couple of others, a couple of other relations. But that process takes years or decades to complete. You can come in here. There's a wait list for your spouse to get in. You can come in. There is a very long wait list for your siblings to come in, depending on what country you're coming from. If you're coming from places like Mexico or India or China, where there's already long wait lists, you can literally wait decades for your relative to come to this country. So this idea of one person just showing up at JFK with 40 people in tow is absolutely out of the realm of reality. But it pushes that, and it's something that his supporters and a lot of other people have glommed onto and have said, yeah, see, this is a problem. They're bringing in truckloads of relatives with them every time they come.
So when you're doing go ahead.
If I may.
Laura, I just wanted to follow up on that real fast. So, Alan, yeah. When you're doing your reporting on this, you are finding that people are genuinely confused about if you get in across the border, that gives you a free rein in some ways to bring in a lot of your family members. People believe that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's been put out there repeatedly over and over, and it just gets in their head. And no matter how many times we try to write articles fact checking this kind of stuff and explaining what the process is, it's a lot easier to just accept that than to sit there and figure out the waiting list for brothers and sisters coming from the Philippines, right? It's just something, it's easier to latch onto, and it's something that's definitely stuck out there.
Laura, you were saying.
Yeah, I want to push back on one point, which is that chain migration is not a derogatory term that was started recently. It's a term that was come up with by some immigration scholars in the 1960s, and it was meant to evoke what it says is that if you are a family member, you can bring in another family member and you start a chain. It has become something that it wasn't intended to be, but it wasn't started by any by the current administration or anyone supporting them. Alan's absolutely right about the wait times. And, you know, I think one of the reasons that people firmly believe this is there is research that indicates the way people feel about immigration has to do with two things. One is, what's the economic situation? As we know, the economy is doing well, so that's not one of the reasons now. And the second one is, how do our leaders talk about immigration? And that's not just our politicians at the national level. That's how are people in your community leading and talking about this issue. And so if all you're hearing are the people that you've elected and are looking up to as leaders saying bad things and spreading misinformation, you're not going to believe the facts that everyone else is putting out.
Well, that's the exact situation we're in right now. But Laura, I have to say, as you point out, if you look back, usually these concerns and this resistance to immigration, legal or not, come up when we're in a difficult economy and people don't feel like there are enough jobs for the people that want to work. We are not in that situation. What accounts for this then? And it's the other piece of that, the way leaders are talking about it?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And, you know, another piece of this that's kind of interesting historically is the last time that we had a real serious backlash to the number of immigrants in the country, we were at about the same percentage of the population of immigrants as we are now. So in the late 19th century, we were starting to get to around 14-15% of our population were immigrants, and we're at about 13.5% now. There seems to be, for some reason, a bit of a tipping point at that point. And so a lot of it, I think, can be attributed to what the messages people are getting are. But if you look around and your community doesn't look the same as it did anymore, even if that's not a bad thing, fear is pretty powerful. And so we're at that point where we were before, and it remains to be seen where we go from here.
Lawrence in St. Paul says, I think there's a difference between immigration and illegal immigration. While the conversations touch each other, they need to be separated. A lot of people support legal immigration. I think we addressed that at the beginning of the discussion. To Matthew in Minneapolis. Hi, Matthew. How does this fit with your own experience here?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a first-generation Ukrainian immigrant. I'm sorry, I believe I'm confusing my term. Second generation. My father was born in a Polish immigration camp shortly after World War II.
Okay.
And they waited there to come over to the United States, deferring both Brazil and Canada. And, you know, so my family is very proud of the fact that they waited and went through procedures to get here. And so they, in general, are of the opinion that immigrants who don't do this are these illegal immigrants. But I think that ignores the fact that we have, over the last 60 years, dramatically changed our views of who we can absorb, of which countries, what constitutes a legitimate reason for those people to come.
Yeah.
And I think Alan spoke to this in response to the Somali caller, that that we are actually shrinking the categories of what can be determined as legal. And there's a weird myopia that comes from those people who think that, you know, they are somehow, they did it the right way, and
right,
everyone else should as well. And I just want to, last point is that my my family, in fact, had to forge their documents, just not state that they were Ukrainian, because in that case, they would be sent back to the Ukraine under Stalin. They had to pretend to be Polish. So, and in fact, they didn't come here legally. They, too, did whatever they could to get here. And I just think it's an interesting lie that we tell ourselves.
So, Matthew, excellent call, because you bring up so much of the complexity of this. And part of this, Alan, is, and this is why the politics don't follow, you know, aren't linear, right? You will find immigrant communities who say, I waited in the line. I did it the way you're supposed to do it. I don't want to see, you know, any kind of amnesty or whatever you want to call it for people who are not doing it the way I did it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, one of my favorite things to do when I'm interviewing people wherever I am is asking them how their family came to the country. And a lot of times, you know, this in no way to say that everyone should be able to come here, but like, it's interesting when they start explaining it. Well, my, you know, they, once they start getting into the story and they start explaining it, and I'm like, that doesn't sound like it was a legal route, or that doesn't sound like, you know, they got a family-based visa and were able to come in. Every one of us here has an interesting backstory, and I think it's very informative for people to think their own family story through before they start kind of weighing in on everything else. But yeah, that general idea of I did it right, so what everyone else should do it that way, it ignores a couple of things. A, that our legal immigration system, I think this is the only thing everybody in Washington agrees on, is terribly broken. We don't have a good guest worker program, so businesses in the U.S. are always just pleading with Congress to update both our high-skilled and our low-skilled guest worker programs. And the process by which people come into the country legally, again, these incredibly long wait lines. There's over 4 million people right now in line waiting to get a green card. And so you tell somebody in Honduras, or you tell somebody in El Salvador, hey, I know you're going through all sorts of gang violence in your community, but why don't you wait 20 years and you'll be able to come into the U.S.? That's not a realistic proposition for a lot of them.
Ivan says on Twitter, third generation immigrant, and I view the assimilation argument as an excuse to demonize the other. First gen immigrants of all backgrounds rarely assimilate. They live a certain way for 30 or 40 years. It's hard to change. It's their children who assimilate via immersion. Alan Gomez from USA Today, Laura Collins with us from the George W. Bush Institute, as we talk about immigration and a lot of the misrepresentation and misinformation around it. And Crystal tweets, biggest misunderstanding is that my parents are refugees, not just immigrants. There are so many assumptions as an Asian about why I'm here in the United States. And then in parentheses, she says, model minority myth. I always have to emphasize that my parents didn't choose to be here, although they are happy that they are. Laura, do you have some insight on first what she's saying about the model minority myth, and then overall her thoughts on that?
You know, I'm not a minority, but the model minority myth, I think, for what she's referring to is, I think that there are some groups that feel like they don't take as much heat simply for who they are. But she would be better positioned to elaborate on that. And can you repeat the second part of the question?
She said, but I do want to follow up on this with Alan, because Alan, I think you were saying, and this came off of a call that we got from Abdi, you know, back when there were European immigrants, yes, they faced resistance too, but that kind of diminished. Is this about the fact that we have more brown and black people coming into the United States?
Now, that's a loaded question. And there's a lot. I mean, that's when we look, that is something that is an accusation. I'll put it this way. It's an accusation I've heard of repeatedly when looking at the actions of this administration. When you look at the, you know, we go back to his comments about his slur against African nations in Haiti. When you look at the countries that have been targeted for his reductions in both legal and illegal immigration, it raises a lot of concerns about that. The way, and on top of that, I think it's the language that he uses when talking about refugees and talking about asylum seekers. The refugee program, all he's talked about over the last year has been the national security concerns about it. We don't hear a lot from this White House about the traditional reasons that refugees come here to our job as the beacon to help people who are trying to flee oppression, who are trying to flee violence. As he's talked about this caravan of Hondurans that are coming up through Central America this last week,
right.
We've heard about asylum as a loophole to get into the country. We don't hear about asylum based on its original meaning, which is people that are trying to flee oppression, trying to flee persecution. We hear about it as a loophole, as a sneaky way to get into the country. And when you look at the fact that a lot of these countries are from Central America, from Africa, from places like that, yeah, it definitely raises that question about whether there's a racial motivation behind it.
Laura, I don't want to miss something here that you wrote a really interesting piece about jobs and the economy and immigration and this debate around skills and low skills and high skills and who we want. Where do you come down on the idea of more skills-based immigration, which President Trump talks about sometimes, but I can't tell if it's at the core of how he would reform the immigration system. What's your argument on that?
You know, our position is that immigration is good for the economy. And so obviously, if you have higher skills, you're going to be in a higher paid occupation. You're going to have more disposable income. You're going to pay more in taxes. And so more high skilled people actually will accelerate economic growth. But that's not to say that we don't need people with different skills. And there are gaps in our economy at both levels, high skilled and low skilled. And so we really take the position that it's important that we fill where we have openings. And currently, the United States doesn't have enough workers to fill most of the openings. And so we're going to either have to find a way to import them or offshore those jobs. And in the long term, maybe it turns into more automation, which is something that scares everybody in a different way than immigration does. As far as how the president talks about high-skilled immigration and focusing on that, he really focuses, I think, his support on the RAISE Act, which was a bill put forth mostly by Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. And it is sort of pro-immigration in disguise in that purports to be supportive of high-skilled immigration, but would drastically cut overall legal immigration levels.
Okay.
And so you would be gaining a little bit on one end at the expense of a whole lot of potential growth on the other end.
So, and Alan, I think we mentioned this earlier. So within this bill, that's right. I remember that President Trump has talked about Senator Cotton's bill. I didn't know that's what it was called. When he talks about bringing in higher skills, what seems lost in the debate around this is that many fewer people would be permitted in legally to the country. How many Americans understand that?
I don't think that much because of the way that we talk about this. He's focused again on we're going to bring in more high skilled people. That's what we want, the best and the brightest. That's what we want to bring in. Those are the ones that are going to help the economy. But we don't hear that next step of explaining, of talking through exactly what Laura was just explaining of what the bill really does. We don't get to that point. And I think the economic, you know, more broadly, I think the economic argument around immigration is one that is probably front and center in what you're talking about, Carrie, in terms of the demagoguery and kind of losing the facts. And I'll just give you one really clear example. President Trump, his first address to Congress last January, he cited a report from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. This was a landmark study where they really pulled together all of the sort of economic data behind immigration and tried to lay it out. And in his speech, the president cited a stat that first-generation immigrants cost U.S. taxpayers $57 billion a year, right? That sounded horrible. That sounded very, very dramatic. But the president left out the literally the second half of the sentence of that report that found that by the time they reached the second generation, immigrants and an economic boost of $30 billion, and by the time they're third-generation immigrants, it's a $223 billion gain for the country. So that's, I think, just one really clear example of how we either cherry-pick or kind of, you know, cloud a lot of the immigration data in a bit of fog and make it a little bit hard for people to understand.
Laura, I have a bit more of the rhetoric that the president used from his State of the Union speech last January, specifically on immigration, and he talks frequently about gang members. Listen to how he put this.
Many of these gang members took advantage of glaring loopholes in our laws to enter the country as illegal, unaccompanied, alien minors.
And we should remember, Laura, that this has been raised again with, as Alan was describing, this caravan situation, many of whom, I understand it, do not intend to come to the U.S. border, intend to seek a status in Mexico or seek asylum if they get to the southern border. But this is also the kind of rhetoric that raises alarms, I think, with Americans who don't understand the issue very completely. What would you say about trying to penetrate some of this misleading rhetoric on it?
Yeah, the unaccompanied minors thing. If you remember from a few years ago when we were having waves and waves of minor children from Central America
right.
come across the southwest border, I think that his statistics on criminal aliens coming through that way are absolutely wrong. I don't think the vast majority of them were gang members. I think the reality, if you were to look at anyone who happened to slip through in that way, the reality was they probably were not a gang member, but maybe they became one when they got here. But the fact is most immigrants of all stripes, legal, otherwise, have lower crime rates than your average American. But when you think about the illegal immigration along the southern border has changed. In the past, we were looking at people who were truly trying to sneak in to work. Excuse me. Now we are seeing, particularly with the Central Americans who are fleeing violence, yes, they want to work, but they're looking for safety. And they're putting their children, they're paying coyotes and smugglers to take care of their children all the way across Mexico. In some cases, their children as young as 10 are riding trains by themselves, you know, climbing onto the top and the sides and just holding on to try to get through the country.
The desperation of that is really extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, and these people are not trying to sneak through the desert. I don't know if anyone, if any of your listeners has been to the U.S.-Mexico border, particularly in Texas. It's very stark. It's incredibly dangerous.
A lot of people make the journey. Risky. Yes.
A lot of people die making the journey. And so what we've seen with the Central Americans, particularly the women and children, is rather than trying to sneak past Border Patrol, they're finding them and declaring that they're here and seeking asylum. And asylum's not automatic. You know, we can give you a protected status right away while we investigate your claims, but you have to have a credible fear. And sometimes we don't find that that's true. And sometimes it's because you really don't have one. And sometimes it's because you just can't prove it. And those people do get deported. And so I think that there's this sort of misunderstanding as to how the system works. We do fully vet the people who'd come and declare asylum. We do run background checks to the extent that we can, and they go through the same process as anyone else that would be trying to enter the country legally.
Laura Allen, thank you very much for what I think was a wide-ranging and I hope insightful conversation on this. I have a feeling we'll continue to talk about it, but good to have you on the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.